His nickname is the Crazy Cajun. He's also been called the godfather of Gulf Coast rock and roll. Huey P. Moe is a Houston-based record producer who's had a lot of hits, combining the blues, country, Cajun, and rock and roll sounds of his birthplace, Louisiana, and his home, Texas. He discovered, then produced hits for Doug Somm's group, the Sir Douglas Quintet, Freddie Fender, Archie Bell and the Drells, and Rockin' Sidney. He's also produced records by Jerry Lee Lewis, T-Bone Walker, and Clifton Chenier. Huey P. Moe was born during the Great Depression. His family was poor. His father couldn't read or write. Moe got his start in music, performing at house parties with his father's Cajun band. Moe says he was too hot-tempered to hold down a job, so he went to barber school and opened up his own shop. But he couldn't keep out of music. He didn't think he was much of a musician or singer, but he loved working in the recording studio. This was Moe's first big hit, Barbara Lynn singing You'll Lose a Good Thing. It rose to number 8 on the charts in 1962.
If you should lose me, oh yeah, you'll lose a good thing. If you should to you, 'cause if you should lose me, oh yeah, you'll lose a good thing.
When you recorded that record, You'll Lose a Good Thing, you were still working in a barbershop in Texas.
Yes, in Winnie, Texas, southeast Texas, where it is, by Beaumont, Port Arthur. It's called the Golden Triangle. It's home of the Big Bopper.
Now, how did you first hear Barbara Lynn? Would you tell us the story behind that?
I was working in the barbershop, and a guy brought me a tape, and he wanted me to hear somebody called T-Baby Green, which was a blues, real blues, down-home blues act. And in between, he was knocking me out, but in between the tapes, it recorded, I had a little Walden sack in them there, and it was recorded on there, and I could hear this girl singing in between. Somebody had recorded over her. And she was just knocking me out, and I said, man, just, you know, I'd give anything to work with that voice. You look at the voice and the song, if you can marry them together, that's the secret to it. And so that one day a guy by the name of James Young, Big Sambo Young, he passed away last year. He come in there and I asked him, I said, James, I said, who's this girl singing right here? He said, oh, he said, it's Barbara Lynn. He said, you want her? I said, yeah, I'd like to have her. And so he come back down there by 6:30 at night. They were just closing up, and he had Barbara with him. Played a left-handed blues guitar and just sang her butt off. It was just too much, man.
Now you said the main thing is to match the right voice with the right song. Did you pick the song for her to sing?
She had sent me a tape after this thing that had 5 songs on it. You Lose a Good Thing was among 5 songs, and I said, that's a hit. And I didn't have the money. I had to get her to I paid the band in New Orleans in the studio, and I bought some Sid Roebuck tape, and I asked if she could make it to New Orleans where I'd record the song, because I thought it was great.
Well, you didn't have the money, but that song ended up making you a lot of money. It was a big hit in 1962.
It still does. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, you had Freddie Fender re-record that.
Yeah,
because
I've always re-recorded. Songs of Timeless, the great songs of love and the sentimental heart affairs, always timeless. They live forever.
So when you made a lot of money from that song, did you get out of the barbershop?
This was my first check. It was real weird. I got a check because we was very poor. My daddy couldn't read and write even when he died a few years ago. We were very poor, and I had a check from my friend here, Harold Lipsis, here in town, for $48,000. And we had never, none of my family all put together, had never seen that kind of money. And I put it in the little bank in Winnie, Texas, and 3 days later, here comes the Narcotics Bureau, the Internal Revenue, and everybody. And I didn't want to make any more money. I thought making money was dangerous, you know. So that's the story behind You Lose a Good Thing. Yes, it was
They
my
couldn't
first...
believe you'd gotten that money legally, huh?
No, everybody thought I was doing something else, because we never had no money. You made $75 a week in the barbershop, so, you know, how could you come up with $48,000? I had a check.
Let's talk about what the record industry was like back then. And and how you got into it. Now, you'd started off in the music business, actually playing in a band with your father.
Right.
Why did you want to give that up and end up behind the mixing console producing records?
Well, see, my father and I played because it was a weekend thing where we picked up a little extra money. We played what we call house dances, you know, where people would pass the hat around because we was very poor. And so that we'd do that only on Saturdays, you know, and finally I got into the radio show on Saturday on KPAC Radio in Port Arthur. And so I got interested in recording, you know, because we did a tape one day and got interested in recording. So it always interests me. I love music so much, and I like rhythms. You know, I've always been a rhythm and a song man. And to me, if I have the song and a great melody and a great song and a nice rhythm, well, all the background don't mean nothing to me. They called it sweeten up. You know, you sweeten up this and sweeten up that. And it's okay, you know, if it needs it, you know. But I'm the person that likes to do it if you don't need it.
Now, you were working and still are working out of Texas. When you were getting started and you were working in a production studio out of Texas, you had to figure out ways to make your records not only regional hits, but national hits.
Yeah.
What were some of the techniques you would use for getting national attention to some of the regional sounds that you were
producing?
Well,
I think it's making hit records like making love to your favorite lover. You know, the feeling is there. It's an emotion, and it's great. It's a great feeling. It has to be there. And if you put that feeling in your records, then everybody in the world's going to feel it.
Yeah, but you still have to get it out on the radio stations and get it to a big label
I went and put that out in Louisiana and Texas, and the records became so big down there that the big labels from New York and up here would come down there to get it. It was a thing that was fresh. It was grassroots, fresh music. And it was different. It was very hard to get it into New York and make them understand that music. But it worked, you know. It worked. It would be the last outpost to break it at, but it would always work.
What, New York would be the last place to play
records? The last outpost, yeah, because it was so... New York has a problem with they like a copy music, something that sounds like this or sounds like that, something. And a lot of the record companies have a hard time hearing something that is original and that is fresh. And New York is a fast-moving pace city. If you make the wrong decision, you're out. Somebody else got your chair and your job next day. So to make decisions on a completely new sound is very hard job for somebody in New York City. And I understand it, you know.
Did you take your records on the road and play them for DJs to get them played on the air?
Yes, I did. I took them on the road. And I did everything I had to do.
Everything you had to do? What
I remember
some of the things you'd
have to do? Dick Clark, when I first met Dick years ago, he played records for me. He's a great man.
This is Dick Clark?
Yes.
So what would you have to do to get airplay on radio stations or on bandstand?
Well, in them days, you did everything. That's before me and Alan Freed days, you know. You just did it. I remember when the first little transistor radios came out, you know, it was a big thing, the small ones. But a friend of mine had a European import in New York. I just went back home with a truckload of them. At Christmas time and all over, I'd come around. Well, here's your transistor. Give your wife one. Give your kid one. Everybody. It was a favor for a favor. You know, it's the way our system of government is based on today, you know. And then they invented the old nasty word payola, which is a bunch of bull, you know. I never believed in it because that's the way you elect your people, anybody.
Would you use money as well as gifts?
Money, sure. One guy in New Orleans wouldn't take money from me. I remember taking a $50, $100 bill and throw it in the trash can and walked out. And I knew he wasn't going to let the guy clean that trash can take that $100 bill out of there. I get in my car and all of a sudden hear my record. And I didn't mind it because that's the game, that's the game.
I want to play one of the many records that you've produced. And let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Huey Moe, who is one of...
Huey P. Moe.
Huey P. Moe,
Name after Governor of Louisiana, all right?
Okay. And he was really like the record producer, the independent record producer in Texas, producing a lot of hits, some of which we'll get the chance to hear today on Fresh Air, such as this next record that we're going to hear. And I want to play She's About a Mover, which produced. You discovered, the Sir Douglas Quintet.
Doug Sam, right? Mm-hmm.
Doug Sam, right. Now, this was 1968. No,
65.
I'm sorry. It's 1965 that this was a hit. It was about the time of the British invasion. It was in the middle of that.
It was a big invasion, too.
Now, did the British invasion knock your records off the charts?
It knocked everybody's records off the charts. They just took over the country.
And so you had to react to that and figure out a way.
It was a matter of they called eating.
Right. So tell us the story about why you named Doug Somm's group, the Sir Douglas Quintet.
Well, I had this idea. I was just trying to figure out the world. I'd figure the world, you know, and I knew that that Doug could play anything. It always bugged me to record, but I knew that I had to have something that sounded a little British, a little different, a little this and that, and it had to be something that came from London, because if it didn't come from London, the disc jockeys wouldn't play it, you know, and I had 8 or 9 records on the charts when the Beatles hit, and every form, and just knocked me smooth off the charts, so I had to go out and find me somebody, you know? And I came up with Doug Somm, and his name was Douglas Wayne, and we tried to get some of them that would sound British, so we came up with the Sir Douglas Quintet, you know? And we did a number and come and wrote some songs off of a Lake Charles two-step my daddy's played. Just use that beat and mix a little Chicano rhythm music along with the Cajun music and came off with the song. Doug wrote the song, and we recorded She's About to Move and the Rains Came, and then went on and told Walt McGuire to leave my name off of it and just put the Tribe record distributed by London Records. And
leave your name off of it so it wouldn't be a giveaway that it was from Texas.
No, it wouldn't be a giveaway, no. And so that it worked. You know, everybody said, oh, wow, here's another record from London. Bow! You know, up the charts it went. And it was fun watching it go.
Let's give it a listen. Okay, you can really hear the regional southern sounds in that. Did it work? Did people really think Douglas was British?
Yeah, and he picked up an accent. He learned
did
that
he really?
Accent down T and had to tighten up Beatles suits for a while, you know, and all that. And he was good at it. The whole band was.
You know, your sound was nicknamed the bathtub sound.
Bathtub sound, because I never did care about a clinical clean sound. I went more for overtones and feelings, you know, that filled all the speakers in the room, like the mono sound. But guys still mix them today. They'll tell you they're stereo, but they mix them down to mono first and then turn around and add a few little left and rights, you know, and it's still full.
Now, once the Beatles started recording in their, you know, a few albums in when they started using fancy stereo techniques and recording backwards and everything. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that to be competitive that you had to get out of the bathtub sound and start making more polished recording studio sounding records?
No,
I didn't.
Mm-hmm. I never believed in trends. I never believed in following anything. I always believed in going by my heart and my feeling and let it rip. You know, if it's got a feeling, it'll make it on its own. If it doesn't, it won't. Just like the Don't Mess With My Toot-Toot, right? Two-three instruments, and Boyd played it all himself. So how do you answer that?
Now, during your career, you've recorded a lot of black performers and white performers.
Right.
Have there been different ways that you felt you had to break both of those records, different places to take them to, different programs to get them on?
Even different mixes.
Really? Different mixes?
Your black mix is a rhythm dance mix. Your bass and bass drum has to be out. Your country or your white rock and roll is what call it back then would be more of the guitar strumming and the voice would be out a lot further and the harmonies would be out a lot further. So you started with your mix right away. And you had to I always like to mix both of them together because a song is a song and the mood's a mood. If it felt good, it felt good. And it would feel good to anybody. But you had to go. You had to start with your rhythm and blues stations first. If you had an R&B record in them days, nowadays you don't have to, you know, because the black and white kids are together and they like each other's music. But they had a way of separating it back then, you know, and it was terrible. But you had to go that way.
Did you ever fool a radio station or a program into thinking that a white group was black or vice versa?
Many times, but I didn't know that. See, in my heart, My mother was like me. She was free and unprejudiced from anything, you know. And I just never did like the prejudice feeling among people. I believe it's a hang up with people, you know, regardless if you're black or white or what. But so I cut my records for a feeling. I figured that everybody would like this ice cream. It tasted good, you know. And so sometimes, especially if I run into more trouble up north, coming up north here, when I had a white act that sounded black. Then anyway, because the minute I would put him on the American Bandstand, if he was white, he sounded black, he fell off the black charts the next day.
Oh, because they realized that he wasn't black.
Yeah, right. It's things that you walk through life, the fields of hatred sometimes, and you meet on the other side. It's pretty when you make it through.
Now, you talked about the black mix being different than the white mix.
Sure.
In the recording studio. I want to play a big hit that you had with Archie Bell and the Drells, Tighten Up. Talk about the mix in this.
Well, Archie Bell and the Drells, the Tighten Up was an opening to the show. But people liked it. He would say, "Hi, y'all, this is Archie Bell and Drell. We're from Houston, Texas, ta-da-ta-da." And then he would start his dance like that. And the people would get off to that, and I kept watching them. I said, "Maybe we ought to just record the introduction to the thing and put it out." And it became a hit record, even though we was pushing the other side of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, called It's a Dog's Eat Dog World. And a friend of mine in Chicago came in drunk at traffic time and put it on the wrong side in Chicago, and all the phones lit up. And so Tighten Up became a hit.
Oh, God, what a great story. Let's hear it. Now, we just heard a hit that you produced for Archie Bell and the Drells.
Right, mm-hmm.
One of your biggest hits was with Freddie Fender, Before the Next Teardrop Falls, which...
In fact, if I could back up just a minute, I got this gold record on Archie Bell and Drells Tighten Up when I entered the penitentiary in Texarkana. Jerry Greenberg had sent it there, and they presented it to me. There, of course, I couldn't keep it. I'd send it in my office.
Now, let's explain. You were in the federal penitentiary for a short amount of time on charges of violating the Mann Act, which is taking an underage woman across state lines.
Mm-hmm.
So you got this gold record right before you went into prison?
As I went in.
As you went in.
As the policemen were bringing me
in.
Oh,
no, literally.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So,
so that's what I did. I tightened up.
Were you a big hit in prison? Did everybody know your music?
Oh, yeah, everybody knew. I had some of my friends in there, too. Disc jockeys were in there, too, and different people I knew.
Huh. And when you got out, that's when you hooked up with Freddie Fender, who I think had also been in federal penitentiary for a while.
In fact, that's why Freddie signed up with me. I asked him why he was signed up with him, because I couldn't figure it out. You know, I was still mixed up for about 2 years then. And he said, "Well, I've been through the same things you have." And he said, "I feel like you don't understand me." And that's the way it worked out, you know.
Now, you had him... Did you pick Before the Next Teardrop Falls?
Yes, I did. I picked every hit song you ever had, and he hated every one of them we recorded.
Why did you think that Before the Next Teardrop Falls would be a good song for Freddie Fender?
Well, I don't know. Freddie was going through some changes, and I had lost a sweetheart about that time, and that song matched the mood and the down times I was having at the present times. And so it was a song that she'd left me for another guy, and the lyrics in it, "If he brings you happiness, and I wish you both the best," you know, and so it matched me, and not only did it match Freddie, Freddie was going through the same changes then, and then just happened to be the one that made it for us, you know.
Well, one other thing, this was recorded as a country song.
Yeah.
And you had him sing the lyric in Spanish in the middle of the record.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of maybe risky thing to do for the country charts?
No, I've always been against the grain. I'm independent and hard-headed. I've always been against the grain. I felt like that it was time for Spanish thing to come on up front. I had produced a lot of Spanish hits over my lifetime in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when I talked to Fred, he didn't want to sing it. He said, "I can't sing that gringo stuff, man." I said, "Well, do it for me," because I wanted him to do it for me, because I wanted to play it for somebody that had left me. See, and so that it just fell right in that slot, and bam, it's a home run. And we had a lot of them after that.
Well, this is that record.
happiness. Then I wish you both the best. It's your happiness that matters most of all. But if he ever breaks your heart, if the teardrop ever starts, I'll be there before the next teardrop falls. Si te quiere de verdad y te da feliz.
That's really a great record. That was a gold record for you.
Yes, probably sold 8 million by now.
You were telling our producer, Amy Sallet,
mm-hmm.
that you finally decided to try to play one of your gold records.
Yes, I did.
Tell me what happened.
In fact, it was this record here, Teardrops. I've had over 52 gold records, and I always wanted to do that. So when they presented me this Four Next Teardrop Fall, I got all wasted one night, and I was sitting in the office. I said, I'm going to try that. Took it out of the frame, and I played the metal part. It was the Supremes record, where I love gold.
Did you feel cheated?
Well, no, it was just funny. I always liked something fresh and something new, you know, and it was something new that I often wondered, you know, was it really my record that made they spread the gold paint on it, you know, but it wasn't. It was somebody else's, which is okay with some good people.
Oh, God, it seems so silly to do that.
Yeah, I know. Nobody but me do that, I believe.
Is there still a regional sound?
Sure.
In Texas, there's still a regional sound?
There's natural sounds everywhere, you know. It's just a matter of people believing in what they're producing. The problem I see with young producers, mm-hmm. if they're listening today, I don't have to tell them what to do, is that they need to diversify and teach themselves to produce different types of music. They get hung up in the heavy metal, and nobody likes Bon Jovi and Striper and everybody better than I do. I love them. I love the song. Per song, not per album, per song that I like to hear them do, you know, just they might go an album I don't like. But I think that the young producers should do as I did over the years and teach themselves to produce the opposite of what they're producing this week, next week, the complete contrast. I think they should teach themselves to produce a little country and should do a little white rock and roll, I guess you'd call it, the backwoods rock and roll with a southern flavor and the heavy metal. And I think they should go from one to the other and not get stuck in the rut, because what happens, they'll pass them up, their little streak of luck's going to go down, and they're in trouble. You never hear from them again.
Now, right now, you're not really producing records much. How come you've taken a break from actually producing and recording?
Well, I do that. I've done that all my life. I go out and make some money. I go out and make money for about 4 or 5 years and cut a lot of hits. And then I said, the hell with it. I go play. I play for 3 or 4 years, and then whenever money's running a little low again, you know, then I get the blues, and then it's time for me to cut another hit record. And it's getting that away now.
One of your many nicknames, I think, is the Crazy Cajun.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
What makes you so crazy? How did you get the nickname Crazy?
I started a radio show in Port Arthur, and I used to get drunk and get up and scream and holler while I spend my music and foot stomping, stop my records in the middle of all that. And people got to writing in the Crazy Cajun. They didn't know my name. A lot of them still don't. So I kept Crazy Cajun and made a publishing company out of it. I became a very big publishing company. And so the name of Huey P. Moe is a... secondary to most people in the business, know me as a Crazy Cajun. Mm-hmm.
Let's give a listen to the last big hit you had a couple of years ago. This is Rockin' Sidney, My Toot Toot. Now, I want you to tell us how you found him and why you had him, do this.
Good.
Tell us how you found him.
Rockin' Sidney has been around. I recorded him 25 years ago. And the guy that he and I produced him together had a big falling out, and it was ironically that we got back together on producing this. And Rockin' Sidney played all the parts in that. He played all the instruments. He's a great writer. He's not the greatest listener on earth, but he's a great writer and a great person. But that's how we come about. That comes out of Lake Charles, Louisiana. He comes from a little town called La Compte, Louisiana. That's where he's from.
Well, before,
he's a great person.
Before we hear this, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been such a pleasure to have
you. Well, I'm glad to be here. I'm going to tell Ed Ward and Austin hello, and he's the one that called me up and told me, and called Amy up, too. I thank you all for inviting me.
We thank you for coming, and thanks for all the listening pleasure you've given us over the years.
I thank you, too.
My guest has been record producer Huey P. Moe, and he's been recording music along the Gulf Coast for decades. Some of the hit records he's produced include Roy Head's Treat Her Right, My Toot Toot, which you're about to hear, by Rockin' Sidney, Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drells, and the Sir Douglas Quintet's She's About a Mover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Rockin' Sydney.
With my toot toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't mess with my toot toot. When she was born in her bird suit, the doctor slapped her behind. He said, "You're gonna be special, you sweet little toot toot." Now you can look as much, but if you much as touch, you're gonna have yourself a case. I'm gonna break your face. Now don't mess with my toot toot. Don't mess with my toot toot. Now you can have the other woman, but don't you mess with my toot toot. Fais pas ça.
Now you can have the other woman, but don't mess with my toot.